Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 4, The Sacrifice, The Triune Path, and The Lord of the Sacrifice, picking up on page 112. Next, the practice of this yoga demands a constant inward remembrance of the one central liberating knowledge, and a constant active externalizing of it in works comes in too, to intensify the remembrance. In all is the one self. The one divine is all. All are in the divine. All are the divine, and there is nothing else in the universe. This thought, or this faith, is the whole background, until it becomes the whole substance of the consciousness of the worker. A memory, a self-dynamizing meditation of this kind, must and does in its end turn into a profound and uninterrupted vision and a vivid and all-embracing consciousness of that which we so powerfully remember or on which we so constantly meditate. For it compels a constant reference at each moment to the origin of all being and will and action, and there is at once an embracing and exceeding of all particular forms and appearances in that which is their cause and upholder. This way cannot go to its end without a seeing vivid and vital, as concrete in its way as physical sight of the works of the universal spirit everywhere. On its summits, it rises into a constant living and thinking and willing and acting in the presence of the supramental, the transcendent. Whatever we see and hear, whatever we touch and sense, all of which we are conscious, has to be known and felt by us as that which we worship and serve. All has to be turned into an image of the divinity, perceived as a dwelling place of his Godhead, enveloped with the eternal omnipresence. In its close, if not long before it, this way of works turns by communion with the divine presence, will, and force into a way of knowledge more complete and integral than any the mere creature intelligence can construct or the search of the intellect can discover. Lastly, the practice of this yoga of sacrifice compels us to renounce all the inner supports of egoism, casting them out of our mind and will and actions, and to eliminate its seed, its presence, its influence out of our nature. All must be done for the divine. All must be directed towards the divine. Nothing must be attempted for ourselves as a separate existence. Nothing done for others, whether neighbors, friends, family, country, or mankind, or other creatures, merely because they are connected with our personal life and thought and sentiment, or because the ego takes a preferential interest in their welfare. In this way of doing and seeing, all works and all life become only a daily dynamic worship and service of the divine in the unbounded temple of his own vast cosmic existence. Life becomes more and more the sacrifice of the eternal in the individual, constantly self-offered to the eternal transcendence. It is offered in the wide sacrificial ground of the field of the eternal cosmic spirit. And the force, too, that offers it is the eternal force, the omnipresent mother. Therefore is this way a way of union and communion by acts and by the spirit, and knowledge in the act as complete and integral as any our Godward will can hope for or our soul's strength execute. It has all the power of a way of works integral and absolute. But because of its law of sacrifice and self-giving to the divine self and master, it is accompanied on its one side by the whole power of the path of love, and on the other, by the whole power of the path of knowledge. At its end, all these three divine powers work together, fused, united, completed, perfected by each other. The divine, the eternal, is the Lord of our sacrifice of works, and union with him in all our being and consciousness and in its expressive instruments is the one object of the sacrifice. The steps of the sacrifice of works must therefore be measured, first, by the growth in our nature of something that brings us nearer to divine nature, but secondly, also, by an experience of the divine, his presence, his manifestation to us, an increasing closeness and union with that presence. But the divine is, in his essence, infinite, and his manifestation, too, is multitudinously infinite. If that is so, it is not likely that our true integral perfection in being and in nature can come by one kind of realization alone. It must combine many different strands of divine experience. It cannot be reached by the exclusive pursuit of a single line of identity till that is raised to its absolute. It must harmonize many aspects of the infinite. An integral consciousness with a multiform dynamic experience is essential for the complete transformation of our nature. There is one fundamental perception indispensable towards any integral knowledge or many-sided experience of this infinite. It is to realize the divine in its essential self and truth, unaltered by forms and phenomena. Otherwise, we are likely to remain caught in the net of appearances, or wander confusedly in a chaotic multitude of cosmic or particular aspects. And if we avoid this confusion, it will be at the price of getting chained to some mental formula or shut up in a limited personal experience. The one secure and all-reconciling truth, which is the very foundation of the universe, is this, that life is the manifestation of an uncreated self and spirit. And the key to life's hidden secret is the true relation of this spirit with its own created existences. There is behind all this life the look of an eternal being upon its multitudinous becomings. There is around and everywhere in it the envelopment and penetration of a manifestation in time by an unmanifested, timeless eternal. But this knowledge is valueless for yoga if it is only an intellectual and metaphysical notion void of life and barren of consequence. A mental realization alone cannot be sufficient for the seeker. For what yoga searches after is not truth of thought alone or truth of mind alone, but the dynamic truth of a living and revealing spiritual experience. There must awake in us a constant indwelling and enveloping nearness, a vivid perception, a close feeling and communion, a concrete sense and contact of a true and infinite presence always and everywhere. That presence must remain with us as the living, pervading reality in which we and all things exist and move and act, and we must feel it always and everywhere, concrete, visible, inhabiting all things. It must be patent to us as their true self, tangible as their imperishable essence, met by us closely as their inmost spirit, to see, to feel, to sense, to contact in every way, and not merely to conceive this self and spirit here in all existences, and to feel with the same vividness all existences in this self and spirit, is the fundamental experience which must englobe all other knowledge. This infinite and eternal self of things is an omnipresent reality, one existence everywhere. It is a single unifying presence and not different in different creatures. It can be met, seen, or felt in its completeness in each soul or each form in the universe. For its infinity is spiritual and essential, and not merely a boundlessness in space or an endlessness in time. The infinite can be felt in an infinitesimal atom, or in a second of time, as convincingly as in the stretch of the eons or the stupendous enormity of the intersolar spaces. The knowledge or experience of it can begin anywhere and express itself through anything, for the divine is in all, and all is the divine. This fundamental experience will yet begin differently for different natures, and take long to develop all the truth that it conceals in its thousand aspects. I see, perhaps, or feel in myself, or as myself, first the eternal presence, and afterwards only can extend the vision or sense of this greater self of mine to all creatures. I then see the world in me, or as one with me. I perceive the universe as a scene in my being, the play of its processes as a movement of forms and souls and forces in my cosmic spirit. I meet myself and none else everywhere. Not, be it well noted, with the error of the Asura, the Titan, who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow, mistakes ego for the self and spirit, and tries to impose his fragmentary personality as the one dominant existence upon all his surroundings. For, having the knowledge, I have already seized this reality that my true self is the non-ego. So always my greater self is felt by me either as an impersonal vastness or an essential person containing yet beyond all personalities, or as both these together. But in any case, whether impersonal or illimitable personal, or both together, it is an ego exceeding infinite. If I have sought it out and found it first in the form of it I call myself, rather than in others, it is only because there it is easiest for me, owing to the subjectivity of my consciousness, to find it, to know it at once, and to realize it. But if the narrow instrumental ego does not begin to merge in this self as soon as it is seen, if the smaller external mind-constructed I refuses to disappear into that greater permanent uncreated spiritual I, then my realization is either not genuine or radically imperfect. There is somewhere in me an egoistic obstacle. Some part of my nature has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial to the all-swallowing truth of the spirit. On the other hand, and to some this is an easier way, I may see the divinity first in the world outside me, not in myself, but in others. I meet it there from the beginning as an indwelling and all-containing infinite that is not bound up with all these forms, creatures, and forces which it bears on its surface. Or else, I see and feel it as a pure, solitary self and spirit, which contains all these powers and existences. And I lose my sense of ego in the silent omnipresence around me. Afterwards, it is this that begins to pervade and possess my instrumental being, and out of it seem to proceed all my impulsions to action, all my light of thought and speech, all the formations of my consciousness, and all its relations and impacts with other soul forms of this one worldwide existence. I am already no longer this little personal self, but that, with something of itself put forward, which sustains a selected form of its workings in the universe. There is another basic realization, the most extreme of all, that yet comes sometimes as the first decisive opening or an early turn of the yoga. It is the awakening to an ineffable, high, transcendent, unknowable, above myself and above this world in which I seem to move, a timeless and spaceless condition or entity which is at once in some way compelling and convincing to an essential consciousness in me, the one thing that is to it overwhelmingly real. This experience is usually accompanied by an equally compelling sense either of the dreamlike or shadowy illusoriness of all things here, or else of their temporary, derivative, and only half-real character. For a time, at least, all around me may seem to be a moving of cinematographic shadow forms or surface figures, and my own action may appear as a fluid formulation from some source ungrasped as yet, and perhaps unseizable above or outside me. To remain in this consciousness, to carry out this initiation or follow out this first suggestion of the character of things, would be to proceed towards the goal of dissolution of self and world in the unknowable, moksha, nirvana. But this is not the only line of issue. It is possible, on the contrary, for me to wait till through the silence of this timeless, unfilled liberation, I begin to enter into relations with that yet ungrasped source of myself and my actions. Then the void begins to fill. There emerges out of it, or there rushes into it, all the manifold truth of the divine, all the aspects and manifestations and many levels of a dynamic infinite. At first, this experience imposes on the mind and then on all our being an absolute, a fathomless, almost an abysmal peace and silence. Overpowered and subjugated, stilled, liberated from itself, the mind accepts the silence itself as the supreme. But afterwards, the seeker discovers that all is there for him, contained or new made in that silence, or through it, descends upon him from a greater concealed transcendent existence. For this transcendent, this absolute, is not a mere piece of signless emptiness. It has its own infinite contents and riches, of which ours are debased and diminished values. If there were not that source of all things, there could be no universe. All powers, all works and activities would be an illusion. All creation and manifestation would be impossible. These are the three fundamental realizations, so fundamental that to the yogin of the way of knowledge, they seem ultimate, sufficient in themselves, destined to overtop and replace all others. And yet, for the integral seeker, whether accorded to him at an early stage suddenly and easily by a miraculous grace, or achieved with difficulty after a long progress and endeavor, they are neither the sole truth nor the full and only clues to the integral truth of the eternal, but rather the unfilled beginning, the vast foundation of a greater divine knowledge. Other realizations there are that are imperatively needed and must be explored to the full limit of their possibilities. And if some of them appear to a first sight to cover only divine aspects that are instrumental to the activity of existence, but not inherent in its essence, yet, when followed to their end, through that activity to its everlasting source, it is found that they lead to a disclosure of the divine without which our knowledge of the truth behind things would be left bare and incomplete. These seeming instrumentals are the key to a secret without which the fundamentals themselves would not unveil all their mystery. All the revelatory aspects of the divine must be caught in the wide net of the integral yoga.